This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Imagine what it's like to have a mother who no longer comprehends that she's related to you. That's the position Deborah Hoffman is in. Her mother, who is now in her mid-80s, has Alzheimer's disease. When her mother's memory started to go haywire, Deborah Hoffman started a video journal to show how the disease was changing her mother and their relationship. She made the journal into a documentary film called Complaints of a Dutiful Daughter. The film was nominated for an Academy Award and will be shown Tuesday night on the PBS series POV. Hoffman has also worked as a film editor on such acclaimed documentaries as The Times of Harvey Milk and Common Threads. This is the first movie she directed. Hoffman told me that her mother seemed to lose her memory chronologically.
The first things that happened were just a loss of extreme short-term memory. So, you know, literally, what did you do a minute before? What did you say a minute before? So she would become very, very repetitive because she would repeat what she'd said the minute before. And then it just kept going backwards. And what remained the longest were the memories of her childhood and her teenage years. And what was kind of shocking to me was what was fairly quickly erased was what I thought of as, you know, the whole body of her life. I mean, the 50 years that she spent married to my father and you know, raising two children, that was sort of the first to disappear. And but her parents, while her children didn't remain clear to her and her husband was completely gone very quickly, her parents to this day still are in her memory.
So that whole part of her life that your life intersects with was gone.
Right. Right, which was very strange.
I want to play a clip from your film that has a lot of phone messages from your mother about a
yes.
hearing aid. Tell us what led up to these phone messages.
Well, everything for a while happened in obsessive stages. And so there would be a topic on the table, and that would be it. That would be what life revolved around. So during this particular period, and I call them periods, I call this one the hearing aid period, she had a hearing aid that was broken, and I had taken it away to be repaired, but I knew that she would be curious, you know, where's her hearing aid, and she would probably go into a tailspin looking for it. So I had left her notes in her apartments saying, I have your hearing aid, it's being repaired, you know, don't worry about it. But, of course, this all just led to a whole new kind of obsession, and she began phoning me rather frequently, wondering in various ways what had happened to the hearing aid. So I saved those phone messages that she left me.
And included them in your film?
Yes.
Monday, 10:30 a.m.
Debbie, I'm your mother, and I think that the hearing aid has improved, do you know?
Monday, 10:35 a.m.
I'm Doris Hoffman, Debbie Hoffman's mother, and I want to get some information on hearing aid batteries. Thank you.
Monday, 10:46 a.m.
I'm Debbie, your daughter, and I wanted to know about the hearing aid. Are you there?
Monday, 11:02 a.m.
Debbie, you were talking to me, but I wanted to find out if there's any news about the hearing aids. Did you follow or did you hang up? Bye-bye.
So what response was left for you to all of these phone messages?
Well, again, everything took a while for me to figure out how to act. So at first, you know, and so I compressed these phone messages into, you know, as if all of these messages happened within the morning of a certain day. Well, I certainly got that many messages in a morning of a certain day, but the point is that the messages actually went on for weeks. So daily, I came home from work to a tape full of messages from my mother about hearing aids. And the variety was incredible. I mean, sometimes clearly she thought I was the repair person. She forgot, you know, and she was just calling And just by stating to some stranger that she was my mother, that would open doors and give her her hearing aid back. And then I do describe in the movie one of the more ludicrous things that I would do. Sometimes she would call when I wasn't at work. I was home, and I picked up the phone, and she would launch into, "Where's my hearing aid? I need my hearing aid." And as I describe in the film, probably the dumbest thing I ever did was say, "Well, you know, I wrote you a note about your hearing aid. Why don't you go and find the note, and then I'll talk to you about the note." Well, so that meant I sent her away from the phone. And of course, she's then in her apartment away from the phone, no longer remembers what she's been sent to find. And I'm left with this phone hanging, and I'm kind of calling louder and louder, trying to get her to hear and come back to the phone, and of course she can't hear because she doesn't have her hearing aid. So it was just this insane situation. It was utterly out of control.
Who was your mother before she got Alzheimer's?
Well, she was very different, obviously, but she was very different in some fundamental ways that are interesting. In terms of just who she was a very educated woman. She was, she still is a very educated woman. She was married to a world-renowned physicist, so she was in a very academic world, a very intellectual world. In addition to just loss of memory, some of the things that have changed, and some of them, oddly enough, kind of for the better. I mean, she used to be a very kind of rigid, judgmental, you know, sort of uptight person. And with the Alzheimer's, and I don't know exactly why, I have some theories, but that sort of fell away. She became a much more accepting, much more affectionate, demonstrative, emotional, outgoing. She's extremely, extremely social now, which is very strange because she's no longer able to say a sentence that I can even begin to decipher what the topic might be. But that doesn't mean she's not very, very communicative and very verbal and very social. And she's in a home with 38 other people, and she's absolutely one of the social butterflies of the place, and that's not remotely the type of person she used to be.
She first started losing her memory in the early 1980s, but it took years before there was an actual diagnosis.
Yeah.
Why did it take so long?
Well, there are a few things I can say in my defense, and then the rest is just because I was, unwilling to face the obvious.
In other words, you didn't have a diagnosis because you didn't take her for one.
Right, exactly, because I just couldn't face it. But in my defense, she had such a slow and long decline, so that she actually began, in retrospect, I realized, she began showing signs of the disease before I had literally even heard the name of the disease. I mean, I clearly remember the first time somebody said to me, "Maybe she has Alzheimer's," and I said, "What's that?" And they described it to me, and I said, "Oh, I don't think so. Don't be ridiculous." And I stayed in that "I don't think so, don't be ridiculous" mode for an embarrassingly long amount of time. And partly because I knew Alzheimer's was a progressive disease, and if she had had strokes that had caused this, then it wasn't necessarily progressive. So I liked that idea a lot better. And taking her to the doctor was the activity she hated the most. So I essentially just avoided it as long as I possibly could, till it absolutely wasn't possible to continue avoiding anymore.
What was the turning point for you when you decided it was time to put her in a home?
Well, there were two things. One was that I had started to have some home care for her, so that she just had somebody with her preventing anything from really catastrophic happening. And I had the home care up to 12 hours a day, and that was still not enough, and yet she wasn't willing to tolerate somebody staying overnight. So there was this terrible fear, oh my God, what is she doing in the middle of the night? She might wake up and walk out on the street in her pajamas and, wander for 2 hours. So something had to change. And also, I felt she was giving me advice. And everything was done in such a non-direct, or maybe non-direct, probably is direct, but such a non-traditionally verbal way. So she became obsessed at one point with packing suitcases. And as with all the obsessions, it happened then all the time, daily, multiple times a day. And no matter what I would do, I mean, I would take suitcases away and I would unpack them. I would try and ask, where are you going? Where do you want to go? But I couldn't get direct answers. No matter what I did, she continued in this packing mode. I mean, she'd find anything. She'd find, you know, an empty box from a cereal and put some things in it. Everything was always packing. And I, you know, chose to interpret that as meaning something, that she was somehow communicating that she wasn't feeling at home where she was. She had some desire to pack and go somewhere else. And she also was a lot of times standing in her apartment, her home, and saying, I want to go home now. So one of the reasons why I've been reluctant to move her was, but how can I take her out of her home where she's comfortable? She's surrounded by familiar things. And then I realized she's not comfortable. She's not surrounded by familiar things. These things are not familiar to her. She wants to go home, and she is home. So how it can't get any worse. Bottom line, it got to the point where I felt like it can't be worse if I move her, because she's already not at home in her home. So I realized I had to.
My guest is filmmaker Deborah Hoffman. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Deborah Hoffman. Her new documentary is about her mother, who has Alzheimer's disease. What do you talk about?
Well, that's very hard to answer because we talk nonstop, or rather she talks nonstop, and I try to make appropriate comments, but I no longer have any idea ever what the topic is. Now, she has a very large vocabulary. She talks very, very much and very expressively. There are certain points where she pauses and laughs, and certain points she sort of shrugs, and you know, she has all the right trappings of a conversation. But, well, I'll give you a good example. Her kind of best pal at the home where she is a woman whose first language was Japanese. And I've noticed that people who have two languages with Alzheimer's, they tend to go back to their childhood language. So this woman speaks only Japanese, and I suspect she speaks a Japanese that's about as comprehensible as my mother's English. So she will speak, I assume, nonsensical Japanese to my mother, who will listen and with just rapt attention. And the friend will pause and they'll both laugh and nod and agree and embrace. And then my mother will begin with nonsensical English and the same thing will happen. And they will converse with each other for hours. But there's no way that they have a clue what each other is saying.
You know, in your film, I found this very interesting. You said that there was one point where you decided to stop trying to always correct your mother when she got something wrong or when she didn't understand what your relationship was and assumed that you were somebody else. You decided, well, what's the point? I'll just play along with it. Mm-hmm. What was the turning point for you?
Well, the turning point was a very silly little thing. And it had to do with what month it was. And I was on the telephone with her, and she had said it was a month that it wasn't. And, you know, as was my habit those days, I felt it was important to tell her what month it really was. Because I, you know, with the best of intentions, I was trying to kind of keep her oriented and help her function and things. And the conversation became really, really dreadful rather quickly, to the point where she was reduced to tears because she could not understand when I kept saying it was August. She just couldn't understand what it was I was saying. And, you know, she had a calendar in front of her and she started telling me that August wasn't in her calendar. And I mean, it just was utterly out of control. And I realized that she had just made a little mistake. She thought it was May, big deal. And by my going off on that and insisting she understand it's August, I had created such pain and confusion for her and panic. I mean, to the point where I hung up the phone and this is another example of how idiotic I got. I hung up the phone. I said, well, I'll be right over. I'll show you August in your calendar. And of course, and by the time I arrive, why on earth are you here? And I don't care about August being in the calendar. You know, it was such a clear example that the problem through that whole interchange was so much more mine than hers. If I had just let her say it was May and let it go by, we would never have had any of this madness that had followed.
So what are some of the things you've since had to play along with?
Well, you know, it's 2 years have gone by since I stopped filming. So the footage in the film is a lot more coherent than the way things are now. So now it's not a matter of going on, along with any specifics. It's just kind of floating along with who knows what. But it used to be. I mean, there were many, many things I went along with. You know, I was her cousin. I had gone to elementary school with her. A very, very common favorite one was that we were in college together. And we, as I mentioned in the film, I mean, we would reminisce about the days in the sorority. And she would ask me if I'd seen any of the AE5 girls lately. And rather than go into my long explanation of how I couldn't have seen them lately because I wasn't in AE5 when she was, because I'm her daughter and blah, 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 I would kind of just throw it back and then see what she had to say. So I would just say, no, I haven't seen any of the AE5 girls lately. How about you? And that would kind of free her up to make up some stories about whether she had or hadn't seen AE5 girls lately and things like that.
Now, something else I thought was interesting in your film, you're gay and your partner is a woman, and you say in the film that your mother, although she never condemned it, she was never quite comfortable with it either. But that seemed to change a little bit when she got sick.
Changed enormously. And it's part of this whole thing where something in her lightened up. There was some sort of, she expresses now a kind of freedom she never had. And I included it in the film for a number of reasons. I found it so interesting that this discomfort that she felt with my being gay appeared to actually have no foundation. It appeared to be, you know, something about, well, what will the neighbors think? I mean, it was in that realm. And that kind of realm of what will the neighbors think disappeared very early on with the illness. So she saw things in a much more, you know, from her own gut. And her own gut was, well, she really, really was crazy about my partner. And, you know, the idea of thinking there was something wrong with it was just, was as ludicrous an idea as I believe it is. And so it wasn't just that she changed a little. I mean, she became deeply comfortable with me and Francis. I mean, to the point where if I would go visit her without Francis, she would always, well, where's Francis? And what was interesting was, you know, her memory was so bad, and certainly for names was so bad, but she, to this day, knows Francis's name, which is extraordinary. There's not, my name and Francis's name are the only names she knows.
You've spent a lot of time taking care of your mother in her old age. I believe you don't have children.
That's right.
Now, do you worry about this, that there won't be a daughter to take care of you when you reach your mother's age?
Very much. Very much. And in terms of the taking care of my mother, at the point that I resented it the most, and I did certainly resent it for, you know, when it was taking over my life, one of the things I would say was, this is not fair. I didn't have children for a reason, and now I have the equivalent of a child. Ultimately, I don't regret any of it. I feel like it was actually an extraordinary experience for me. But yes, I worry very much because, first of all, they do say that there's a strong genetic component to Alzheimer's. And no, I don't have a dutiful daughter that is waiting in the wings. But that's kind of the end of my answer. Yes, I worry. I haven't come up with a solution yet.
Are you hoping that there will be all kinds of, like, alternative models for older people by the time you're old?
Well, I'm hoping for a lot of things.
You're right. Yeah.
I'm hoping very soon for a cure for Alzheimer's. as I lose my keys daily, I'm waiting for that to come. And I'm hoping for a very different system. There's a sort of insane thing that goes on in the health system here. If you have Alzheimer's, the kind of care that you ultimately need is custodial care rather than medical care, and that is not covered by anything. So, for instance, the facility that my mother's in, which is quite wonderful, you can't be there if you don't have the funds to be there. So what most people end up doing, and I figure without a daughter to look out of for me, this is what someone would do with me. You take a person with Alzheimer's and you put them in a nursing home rather than a care facility. And a nursing home is not what they need, and a nursing home is not capable or equipped to care for them. And that's how they end up, ultimately, the nursing home can't deal with the person with Alzheimer's because they're agitated and they're wandering, and so they give them drugs to calm them down, but they're still wandering, so then they put them in restraints. And it's the worst, and it costs way more than a care facility, but it's covered. So it's the worst of all possible scenarios. It's the worst possible care at the most possible cost. And that's what most people in this country now do. So I certainly hope that will have changed by the time I get there.
Which mother do you most want to remember, or are you able to hold the memory of your mother before and after she got sick in your mind at the same time?
I'm not easily able to hold both in my mind. It's interesting. I'm much more aware of the current mother these days. And I imagine that when my mother dies, I'm in for a big shock, because I suspect that that's when it's going to be when I'm suddenly flooded with the memories of who she used to be. I think I just can't allow myself to remember that too much. And there's so much kind of happening in the present, and it's not as if she's faded away. She has such a strong personality presently that I focus on that, and I don't much think about who she used to be.
Forgive me if this is an annoying or overly heavy question, but, you know, your mother has forgotten everything about her life except her childhood. So she's, you know, she's forgotten any work that she did. She's forgotten her family. I mean, she's forgotten mm-hmm. you and her and your father. Mm-hmm. Does this lead you to this kind of existential despair of, you know, well, what's the point of anything anyways? If you're going to end up like this and forget everything good and bad that ever happened to you?
Well, I think that one of the reasons I probably made this film was so that when I'm like that, you know, there'll be something that remains, and I'm hoping it'll be this film, and I'll be one of those obnoxious people in the home that walks around and grabs everybody and says, you got to come look at my film, and I put it in the VCR, and I'll have this tangible reminder of something that I did.
Deborah Hoffman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
Deborah Hoffman's documentary, Complaints of a Dutiful Daughter, will be shown Tuesday night on the PBS series POV. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.